This is Ray Kestenbaum of the Public Relations Department of Bell Laboratories, May 11th, 1965. Today with me here in Washington, D.C. is the brother of the late Carl Jansky, Cyril M. Jansky.
No, beg your pardon, I don't use the Cyril. C.M. Jansky, Jr.
C.M. Jansky, Jr.
That's right. I use the middle name.
Mr. Jansky, could you outline some of the things since your brother's death that have been done tributary to him to honor him in the field of radio astronomy?
I think probably the most important things that have been done have to do with statements which have been made in books and in articles attributing the discovery to him. I personally have had requests from any number of sources for his picture by those who were writing textbooks and who were anxious to include his picture.
Could you name some of these?
I don't have a record of them now, but I recall specifically that at least one or two of these requests came from authors from behind the Iron Curtain. This appears to be a discovery which is universally attributed to him. I have never heard anyone question the fact that he was the first man to detect radiation from interstellar space.
When I say tributary, Mr. Jansky, I'm referring to things like the naming of a laboratory to him.
Yes, I think that should be mentioned. The radio astronomy facility, the National Radio Astronomy facility at Greenbank, West Virginia, contains a very outstanding tribute to him. The large laboratory building there is named the, quote, Carl Gute Jansky, or Jansky Laboratory, unquote. I might comment that over here in the United States, the name is always Jansky. Actually, in Europe, where there is no hard J, the name is pronounced Jansky, but it's always called Jansky here. Do you want me to...
No, I want to just sort of list them, because I'm not too familiar with them. Were there any other tributaries?
The other tribute is that there is a unit, universally accepted now, which is named for Carl, and I might indicate exactly what that unit is. Can you stop that machine occasionally? There is in common use today a basic unit of power flux density, which is called the Jansky. Now, these are, I think, the outstanding tributes to him. 25 years, approximately 25 years after his discovery, rather in 1956, American Astronomical Society at its annual convention held in the spring of 1956 in Columbus, Ohio, paid tribute to him, and it was my privilege to give the banquet address at this convention. And this address was a history of his life, plus a history in non-technical terms of the steps he followed in arriving at the conclusion, arriving at this discovery.
Is this the same history that's documented in your presentation?
Yes.
To the IRE?
Almost, but not quite.
Yeah, one is in verbal form, the other isn't.
But there are one or two things in the IRE paper which appeared 25 years afterwards, which do not appear in the other. I wish you'd turn it off a minute. Pattern.
Mr. Jansky, I want to ask you this question. In your opinion, your estimation, how high up do you think your late brother's invention ranks? Would it rank, say, with the discovery of penicillin, with the discovery of subatomic particles? Do you think, for example, this discovery ranks with the kind that Nobel Prize winners win?
Yes, of course, it is in a different field than the discovery or development of penicillin, which really was a development. But I think there is no question but it is. It was one of the basic discoveries in the field of pure science, ranking with some of Galileo's work and others in this field.
Who else do you know outside of, say, the Bell Laboratories that feels this way?
Well, I might quote from what Sir Edward Appleton, who, of course, was an outstanding scientist in this field.
Edward Appleton of England.
Sir Edward Appleton of England. He was attached to Edinburgh University. Statement he made 20 years after the discovery in his 1953 presidential address to the British Association for the Advancement of Science. He said, stop about a minute, please. I haven't found what I wanted. He stated that Karl Jansky's discovery ranked with Galileo's discoveries, and particularly his discovery of the satellites of Jupiter. I think probably that is one of the most outstanding tributes that was paid to his discovery. Now, I might also offer this comment, which admittedly is hearsay. I cannot justify it by reference to any of the literature, but it is my understanding that the time of Karl Jansky's death in February 1950, that he was under consideration for the Nobel Prize.
Can you qualify this here?
No, I regret that I can't. I have heard it said, but I can't justify it by any reference to the literature. This probably, I could check this in Stockholm, where I have many contacts. But
well, let's go on here. Let me ask you this, Mr. Jansky. Do you think that Karl realized the importance of his discovery at the time? Did he know the ramifications of it? Did he know what it might have might lead to at the time?
Well, I think he did have a considerable vision of what it might lead to, but I doubt if any living person at that time could have visualized the magnitude of the science which would be built upon his discovery.
Do you recall whether Karl thought at the time that there were any other radio sources save that of coming from the center of the Milky Way? Did he ever talk about this?
Yes, he did. Among others, I think he felt, and I think his papers will show, that he was under the impression that among other sources, the sun would be a source.
Yes.
Of,
what about other stars?
I think he felt that too. But I know specifically, I think he mentions in some of his papers that he thought the sun was a source, and of course this was proved later.
During and after his discovery, did he ever attempt to explain the reasons for this radiation? Did he attempt to inject any theory into it?
I don't recall that he did. I don't recall that he did.
Would you consider Mr. Jansky, your late brother, having been capable of working up a theory to explain radiation, galactic radiation? He was an extremely capable experimentalist in measuring.
I think he would, but I think it's important to bear in mind that he was not one to sit down at the table and concoct theories. He was more inclined to take data and then to analyze those data with a view of seeing what the data showed. And this was the way in which his mind worked during this whole study that he made, a study which, of course, occupied several years.
Were there any other projects which he did before joining Bell Laboratories, such as the University of Wisconsin, from which he graduated, that tended to show him as this gifted experimentalist that he was? Patient data taker.
I am not familiar with the work on which he obtained the master's degree several years after he.
Is that at Iowa?
No, Wisconsin.
Wisconsin.
Yes, he graduated in the Department of Physics from the University of Wisconsin, the same department, the same university that I graduated from. He later did the thesis work that resulted in his getting the master's degree. At the moment, I am not familiar with the nature of that thesis work.
Okay, let's get on with this question. Carl at the time was working on the measurement of static in connection with problems in the transatlantic circuit. And he was involved in various types of static, and studying the reception of various kinds of static, its direction, its level, etc. Then he came across this hissing noise, which he spent the beginning 2 years, at least 2 years, before he decided that this was of extraterrestrial origin. Do you think, Mr. Jansky, that the hissing noise type of static occupied his interest more than the other noise sources which he was involved
in? Well, that is difficult to answer. Of course, he found, after he built his rotating antenna, and he set about making continuous records of static, he found three sources. One was, of course, static from local thunderstorms. The second was static from thunderstorms at considerable distance. And the third was this hiss-type static, which at first he was inclined to attribute to radiation from the sun. The reason being is that when he first started to analyze his data, the direction, this is by chance frankly, the direction in which the static was coming was the direction of the sun. But then it began to change in direction. In other words, the direction advanced by about 4 minutes of time per day. And this worked out, of course, to be such that at the end of the year, it was coming from the same direction it had when he started. This obviously indicated that the signals, if you call them signals, or the electromagnetic radiation he was receiving was coming from a point which was fixed in space.
Yes.
I might say that during this period when he was analyzing this direction, and I think this is a point of some importance, there is evidence, I believe, to the effect that one or two other people had detected, or at least had received this type of static.
Previously.
But they did nothing about it.
Meaning publishing.
Well, they didn't even attempt to determine the direction of the source and attempt to relate it to anything.
Yes.
Now, about the time that Carl decided that this was coming from a fixed point in space, he started to study astronomy, astronomical coordinates, a subject on which he had no previous knowledge. So, having become thoroughly familiar with astronomical coordinates, what they mean, he was then able to specify in astronomical coordinates the direction from which this hiss static was arriving on this for the record was on a frequency of 20.53 megacycles per second.
Right.
Or expressed in terms of meters wavelength, it was 14.6 meters. Now, the a real credit to him, I think, is that having determined that he was receiving electromagnetic radiation, I don't quite like to use the term static as applied to it, but is that he went out of his way to study another science. And to relate this to astronomical coordinates, I might say that not being an astronomer myself, I find his explanation of astronomical coordinates and what they are as they appear in his papers to be more lucid and more understandable than almost anything I've read on the subject in this.
Including those written by astronomers.
That's right.
Mr. And Jansky, were you, I'd like to establish where you were at the time. Were you here, Jansky and Bailey, in the years 1928 to
33? I was here, yes, in 1928. I was practicing, I was professor of radio and electrical engineering at the University of Minnesota. I was on leave of absence in 1928 doing consulting work in Washington. I opened my office as an independent consulting engineer, radio and electronic engineer, in 1929, and I formed the partnership Jansky and Bailey in September of 1930.
Right.
So I was in the East, and I was in quite close touch with his work.
Were you in close touch with Carl himself?
Yes.
Did he, how often would you say he contacted you?
Well, we would get together several times a year.
A year?
Yeah, we'd get together several times a year, and he discussed what he was doing and what his work was with me.
Did he write you aside from this meeting, or was he a letter writer?
No, I think we did most of this by personal conference.
Say about 5 to 10 times a year?
Yeah, well, about that often, yes. I would say nearer 5 than 10.
Were you tuned in to his work at the time? In other words, were you aware of what he was doing before any announcement was made?
Yes, I was. I was in close touch with him. There was nothing classified about what he was doing, and he was free to talk about it. I visited the laboratory any number of times. I saw his antenna system. I saw his recording equipment.
What years were these?
These were, I would say, in the early 1930s.
Before the announcement came.
That's right. As a matter of fact, at that time, I was a member of the board of directors of the Institute of Radio Engineers. I was later president in 1934. But if my, and I was the Institute of Radio Engineers representative and delegate to IRSA. Now, don't ask me at the moment what the letters IRSA stand for. I can find it.
It's documented.
It's documented.
Yeah.
It's primarily the name.
Universal Radio, something or other. Yeah.
Scientific Union. And in those days, it was my job to act as presiding officer at some of the sessions of IHRSA, which were held in the spring of each year, usually in April.
You were an officer in IHRSA?
I was the Institute of Radio Engineers representative director of IHRSA.
Were you in command at the time?
My memory is correct, and I believe it is. I presided at the meeting at which Carl spoke in 1932 here in Washington, down here at the building on Constitution Avenue.
That was quite an epic experience.
I'm perfectly willing to admit that the tremendous importance of that at that time, it was not as thoroughly recognized by me as it was by him.
Yeah, I want to get to that. Actually, now, in the IHRSA paper, this, I believe, was the first one which was to come before the public. It came before the IRE paper, which was the next fall. I wanted to ask you concerning this point, how did you feel about his work at the time? Did you feel that it was as earth-shaking as, he didn't even feel it was earth-shaking. But did you feel, were you convinced that it was as important as Carl thought it was, or some of his colleagues did? How did you feel about the working,
I suspect he felt it was more important than I did.
I see.
As a matter of fact, although I felt that it was important.
Did you dissuade him or persuade him, or were you neutral as far as him continuing this sort of work?
Well, I was in hopes he would continue it and be allowed to continue it.
In other words, you were not intrigued by the hiss noise yourself. You didn't think it was any.
Well, I didn't. I didn't see the future of the science that's built on it. I don't think anyone did.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it would not have taken so long for others to pick it up.
Now, he spent 2 to 3 years studying and tracking this down, and yet a great many people, didn't think this worthwhile, particularly since it wasn't the dominant factor in the transatlantic noise. And you yourself say, Mr. Jansky, that you didn't think it was at anything extraordinary at the time.
No,
but you did feel that he should continue, is that right?
I felt that. I felt that, but I didn't attribute to it the importance that I should have. Of course, the man who picked it up first was Grote Reber.
Reber.
Yes.
Let me ask you this. Did he ever express an interest to you in wanting to pursue this work after the discovery was made?
Yes, he did.
Could you explain this?
Well, he...
What did he say to you?
Well, he thought it was worth following. On the other hand, I think it's important to note that Carl was a very modest individual. And he was... he worked on this as long as he could. And since it didn't have any direct bearing on the project in which he originally started, and there were many reasons why there were emphasis on other things, it's understandable as to why he wasn't kept at this. For instance, even in those early dates, there was the threat of war, and...
War with Germany?
Yes, there was a threat, at least. There was a defense effort, it's understandable that emphasis in work should be switched to those things having a direct bearing on the defense effort. I know that we ourselves in Jansky and Bailey became involved in defense contracts quite a number of years prior to our getting in the war. And of course, this was true of other laboratories as well.
Yes. What I wanted to know, sir, was Carl had expressed to you the desire to continue this work after the announcement of his discovery was made. Can you tell me, can you relate to me how he said this to you, what he said to you? Did he want to pursue the study of radio? Did he want to pursue, did he want to find other hiss noises similarly?
Well, he had expressed this interest in me, but I think you can get even better information on this part from his widow. Because, of course, she knew what he was doing, and when it came to expressing his real desires in this, and what he wanted to do, she can give you better information than I am, because, of course, they were together all the time. And I'd be inclined to suggest that you talk to her.
I see. But he did mention to you the fact that he wanted to continue in this field.
Yes, he did, but mildly.
I see.
He made no tremendous point of it. He was inclined to take the orders given to him and not question them. He didn't raise any great to-do about it.
My next question, Mr. Jansky, is... I wanted to ask you about if Carl was the kind of person, in your opinion, your estimation, if Carl was the kind of person that needed the acceptance of his peers and superiors to carry on his projects, or was he the kind of person to pioneer a subject despite the perhaps unpopularity of a subject or the general disbelief of a theory?
I would say the latter. I would say the latter.
That he was the kind of a person...
That's right.
...who would pioneer.
Yes, to the extent possible, but he wouldn't quarrel with anybody if they decided he was to do something else.
Do you think...
I kind of feel it's too bad he was not more insistent on this sort of thing.
He wasn't too insistent?
No, that's right.
What do you think prevented him from furthering this study?
I think it's his own modesty. I think it's his own... He had great respect for the people he was working with, and if they wanted him to do other things, why, he wouldn't question... he wouldn't put up a terrific fight to continue in this field. I don't think this is any... lack of interest on his part.
Yes.
It's just the fact he was that kind of a man.
Now, you say the fact that he wanted to continue in this work, this is this information you got from his wife, from his widow.
Also what he told me, but he told her much more about him than he did me.
I see. Now, you were familiar with the situation in the field at the time. Of course, there was an economic depression then.
That's right.
The question is now, if he did want to further this study, in studying extragalactic sources, could he have done this elsewhere? Could he have left... Was it possible in those days to do this kind of work somewhere else? Could he have left Bell Laboratories, for example, gone on to a university or an industrial laboratory, or struck out on his own?
I think it would have been more likely to have been at some university rather than on his own. Of course, he had a living to make. He had a family. And, however, it's interesting to consider the situation which existed at that time. I know of no institution, no commercial institution, that throughout its entire history has devoted more time, effort, and money to pure research than Bell Telephone Laboratories and its predecessor, Western Electric. It was my privilege to work in Western Electric before Bell Laboratories was formed, and I saw evidence of that in the work which was done at 463 West Street. Let me finish.
Yes.
Now, this interest in pure research, which might at the moment have no commercial value, and this willingness to devote time, effort, and money to it, was, I believe, at least on the basis of whatever knowledge I have, almost unique. This was a period of time when pure research was left largely to educational institutions. And it's also important to bear in mind that at this period of time, the government was not supporting pure research to anything like the extent that is now. So it was common practice in industrial laboratories to limit the work done by its scientists to specific progress which showed some chance of having real commercial value.
Yes.
This difference between the situation that existed in those times, and also it is important to bear in mind that this was a period of depression, in contrast to the situation which exists today, is worthy of note. If Carl had wanted to continue his work in radio astronomy, there would have been only one course open to him, and that is to see if he could not find a position in some physics department, in some educational institution.
Did he actually attempt this?
To the best of my knowledge, no. He was loyal to the laboratories. He liked his work there, and he liked the people he worked with.
Yes. John Pfeiffer documents a letter that he purportedly had correspondence with your late father. Do you know anything about this letter?
I'm not familiar with it at the moment. I know that he corresponded a great deal with his father. And I think his father was one of those who early recognized the importance of this. Of course, his father was a scientist, a graduate in physics and electrical engineering from the University of Michigan, and he held higher degrees from that institution as well. And his father was a professor of electrical engineering. And I do recall specifically that our father, in those early days, was tremendously impressed with Carl's discovery. And I recall in these early days, he's making a statement to me that he thought this was an exceedingly basic discovery in the field of science.
Yes.
Our father, I think, had a greater vision of the importance of this discovery than some of the rest of us did.
Did he in any way guide Carl or suggest things to him in the course of his research?
I have not studied this correspondence between father and Carl.
Yes.
That probably would show that he offered many suggestions on it, but I can't document it.
Okay. Let's go on to this point, Mr. Jansky. Who was the one that suggested Bell Labs in the first place to Carl?
Who? I am not sure. I know that I supported his application. And when he applied for his position, at first there was some tendency not to employ him because of his known physical defects.
Yes.
I can't remember this man's name, but the man in the laboratories who had charge of employment at that time was a very good friend of mine, and I talked with him about Carl. And ultimately, I don't know whether what I said had very much to do with laboratories hiring him or not, but at least I argued for it in spite of his physical difficulties.
Yes, and he did get the job.
Yes, he did.
And he moved out to the country.
That's right.
Mr. Jansky, could you recount to us your own experience with the labs? I'm totally unfamiliar with this. What were the periods that you worked at the labs? When did this happen?
I graduated in physics from the University of Wisconsin in 1917. At that time, although I'd had 4 years of military training, they wouldn't take me in the Army. One reason was my eyesight was bad, and the second reason, which seems peculiar now, is I was badly underweight. So, we were encouraged to go into work which would have some, which would be helpful in the defense effort. So, in about April of 1917, I joined the staff of Western Electric Company.
April 1917?
I think it's about April. Anyhow, I graduated in absentia because I was at the laboratories at 463 West.
And how long did you work at Western?
I worked under Crandall. And Crandall's specialty was sound. And we were working on problems related to submarine detection.
For how long a period did you work at Western?
I was there, if my recollection is correct, something over a year.
Until 1918 or so?
Yes. And then I went back to the University of Wisconsin, where under Max Mason and under Professor Terry, I continued to work on the same problems, because they were working on submarine detection there. And also, at this time, worked on radio telephone developments, because my thesis work at the University of Wisconsin had to do with the design construction of electronic vacuum tubes and their use in radio telephony. There we established a radio telephone station in 1918, which is the oldest radio telephone broadcast station in the United States.
So.
And then my other contacts with the laboratories were during summer periods.
Were you an employee there? Or?
I was an employee, yes. I left the University of Wisconsin in 1920 and joined the faculty of the Department of Electrical Engineering, University of Minnesota. And the summer of 1920, I spent in the laboratories at West Street. This time I worked...
it was still Western Electric.
It was still Western Electric. This time I worked under Nichols. And at this time, I was particularly concerned with radio telephone problems and with the use of vacuum tubes. Some of the people I worked with were E.L. Nelson, now deceased, housekeeper, who was working on, at that time, on the development of water-cooled tubes. Then, throughout all the period of time that I was at the University of Minnesota, I kept in close touch with the laboratories. My dean and the head of my department were very kind. They allowed me to make trips east, and I spent quite a little time with people in the laboratory.
So you left the laboratory because you were essentially an academician. You shuffled between...
At that time I was, yeah.
The university and...
At that time I was.
So the period you worked at the laboratory, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is about 1 year, starting with 1917 and the summer of 1920. Those were your official engagements as an employee.
Those were my official engagements. Now, I would have to look at my records, see whether I didn't... I think I spent other summers there.
As an employee?
I think so, yes.
One or two?
One or two others.
Okay.
I'd have to check to make sure, because about this time the laboratories became concerned with securing graduates to go into the telephone work, and the laboratories, the Western Electric Company and the Bell people, started holding educational conferences.
Yes.
And it was my privilege to attend some of those as well.
Okay. Coming back to your late brother, Mr. Jansky, I wanted to ask you, did you detect in Carl any change of personality after he came to fame through his discovery?
I wouldn't say
was
so.
Was he the same fellow?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I didn't detect any whatsoever.
Do you think that he ever accomplished or ever set out to accomplish anything comparable scientifically in subsequent years?
That's a hard one to answer. I know that he worked on amplifier circuits, and also, I guess this is entirely unclassified now, but one of the projects which he worked on had to do with what they call fingerprinting radio transmissions.
I didn't know about this.
Yes. It is possible, for instance, let's relate this directly to submarine operations. Now, I don't believe this is classified now, but it's perfectly possible to take the radio transmission from a radio transmitter, and if you study it, spread it out, you can usually identify a particular transmission with a particular transmitter.
Now,
this is something you folks have got much more data on
than
I have, but I know he did work on this project.
Did he receive any patents on this?
Not to my knowledge.
No. Sir, do you think that your brother was happy working at Bell Labs?
Yes, I think he was very happy there.
He liked the work he was doing?
Oh, yes.
Do you think at any time, did he ever express any dissatisfaction with his job after his discovery?
No, I don't recall that he did. He wasn't the kind of a person who would have. He was a very modest man.
Did he speak with favor, with high regard about his bosses?
Oh, yes.
Then actually, let's get back to the statement now, the one that you wrote in this 25th anniversary tribute. You said he would have preferred
to continue.
He would have preferred to continue his work.
That's correct.
And you know this to be a fact.
Yes,
could you,
I do.
Could you qualify this? Could you explain this a bit?
Well, there isn't much to be said about it.
Yeah.
He would have preferred to have continued on it. This I know, not only from what he told me, but from what he told my wife, his wife.
Yes.
She can expand on that point much more than I can.
Fine. I have just two more questions, Mr. Jansky. I'd like to know sort of your own chronology. For example, when Jansky and Bailey started. You mentioned you established this business in 1929.
Yes, or 1928, really.
1928.
I started... Well, this is one of the things that's hard to put a date on, because, you see, I was at the University of Minnesota. I established a broadcast station there in the spring of 1920. And as commercial broadcasting developed, I started having clients. I represented one of the big stations there. I did considerable work for the Chicago Tribune, so I found myself in the position of...
Work for the Chicago Tribune?
That's right.
In what capacity?
I was consulting engineer for the capacity in connection with a case involving another station's pirating a frequency which is too close to it. I spent a number of months there preparing evidence as an expert in that case. This, if my memory is correct, was 1926. So about 1928, my consulting business had reached a point where I was making as much money in that as I was in teaching, and felt that I had to make a decision. That is, if I tried to carry on both, one would suffer. If I expanded the consulting business, the teaching would suffer. If I continued and specialized in teaching, the consulting would suffer.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided that I'd take a whirl at it by myself on the outside. In 1930, I decided that the consulting business was big enough that you needed help, so I brought with me Mr. Stuart Bailey, who had taken the master's degree under me at the University of Minnesota, and we've been close business associates ever since.
Has your business ever had any contact with the Bell Laboratories in the interim?
Yes, we've done contract work under the Bell Laboratories.
The Bell Laboratories has contracted you to
do
jobs?
Yes, that's right. And also, while I was with the Air Force during the war, I was given the job of developing operations research and air defense. I was instrumental in getting a pretty substantial contract for Bell Laboratories to do some systems engineering and operations research for air defense.
Your relations with Bell Laboratories is good, I think.
Oh, yes. I have many friends there, and the highest regard for the organization. As a matter of fact, the man responsible for... Can you stop it just a minute? We can come back to that if I get these
things. How much senior are you, Carl?
Let me see. Carl was born in 1905, and I was born in 1895, so 10 years.
10 years. Mr. Jansky, could you describe the principal occupation of Jansky and Bailey? What is this enterprise? What are you people mainly concerned with?
Jansky and Bailey in the 1930s was an independent consulting engineering organization which represented broadcast stations. We handled their allocation problems, their engineering problems for the Federal Radio Commission, later the Federal Communications Commission. Uh, We had no connection with manufacturing organizations and don't yet. Many of the cases before the Federal Communications Commission were controversial. For instance, two applicants for the same facility, in which case there would be a hearing. These hearings would call for technical evidence, is what you propose to do, the kind of antennas you propose to use, and facilities you need propose to put in. Also, at times, we would handle engineering with respect to complete installations, just exactly like an architect would handle the design of a building.
Yes.
Then in 1936, we became very much involved the application of radio communication electronics to the maritime industry.
Ship-to-shore communication.
Ship-to-shore and ship-to-ship communication. Since 1936, we have continuously represented Lake Carriers Association, which is an association of 25 companies operating all of the bulk freighters on the Great Lakes, about 300 of them. So, in the consulting business, our two big areas of activities are broadcasting and television engineering, an area which we still carry on, and also a service to the maritime industry.
I see. Are you retired now, sir?
No, I will. I'm not retired yet. I will retire this summer.
I see. And people carrying on your work here?
Oh, yes. For instance, Jaskin Bailey now, there are three Jaskin Bailey divisions of Atlantic Research Corporation. My title is chairman of the board. Mr. Bailey's title is president, and he is also a vice president of Atlantic Research Corporation. We now have about 150 employees. There is a wide variety, carry on a wide variety of projects in the defense effort. We have a pretty extensive laboratory. So actually there are...
Here in Washington?
This is at Edsel Row, here in this area. There are three divisions to Jaskin Bailey. There is a broadcast and television division, which handles broadcast and television engineering, and this is right in this building here. Then we have a systems engineering and operations research division, which plans communication systems.
Was it O.E. Buckley?
No.
Was it Larry Harrison?
No. No.
Yeah. Very well, then. To conclude, Mr. Jansky, do you think that there are any loose ends about the Carl Jansky story? Do you think that there's anything still to be done? Is there anything that you would like to see done with regard to discovery of your late brother? Any honors that should be bestowed upon him? Any meritorious things? Any salutations? How do you feel about this?
Well, there are a couple of things that I would like to have done. I know that there was a project to have a model of Carl's antenna on exhibition in the laboratory at Greenbank. Now, whether that was ever done or not, I'm not sure, because it's been a number of years since I've been to Greenbank. But I think it might be worthwhile to pay a visit to that laboratory.
You are for the antenna to be put there?
Oh, very much so. I think that...
Well, they are putting the antenna there.
They are?
Yes.
Good. They're putting the antenna itself, or a model of it?
A model of it. A
model of it. After all, it's pretty big. Pretty big.
Well, this antenna has been disassembled here.
Yes, But a full-scale model would be too big, but I think a model would be good.
It's possible that the original is in the Smithsonian. I'm not sure. Do you know anything about this?
I don't know. I don't know as to that. Now, there is another project that I started on, but never finished.
What was that all about?
I have had a number of requests from time to time from libraries for copies of his original papers. Particularly the two papers that he gave on this subject. I have had in mind taking these two papers, putting with them a copy of the address which I gave for the American Astronomical Society in 1956, and republishing them, that is, putting them together in one book. And then, if the proper channels can be found to distribute these to libraries, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. My original plan was to, if necessary, to do this at my own cost. I'm sure there would be no difficulty in obtaining permission from Bell and from the Institute of Radio Engineers to republish these. Because I believe that, now these are the only two copies of these papers which I have. I originally had quite a large number of them, but I've sent them out. I've kept these. And I would suggest that the laboratories might consider putting together these two papers, plus my paper, which is descriptive of his life, plus anything else which might be desirable. Perhaps Salford's paper could be added to this list, because I think Salford's detailed analysis of what Carl did is a very masterful piece of work.
Yes, it is. Incidentally, did Southworth consult with you when he wrote his piece?
I don't think he did. I talked to him about it. Mm-hmm. I've used it as source material. Of course, Southworth had the advantage of having available Carl's notebooks, and he drew on this information very extensively in this paper he did. And it might be worthwhile to add this. And if Bell Laboratories feels that they would like to cooperate with me in a project of this kind, I'd be very happy to cooperate. Mm-hmm. If we can spend a reasonable amount of money on it, I'm prepared to spend some of my money on it, as far as I'm concerned. I think this would do credit to the laboratory.
Yeah. Would you still feel the same way about that statement at the end as well?
Well, this isn't in any... this is not in that address. This... the only reason I put that in is because I was told by the people I talked to that it ought to be in the records.
You mean by Lloyd Berkner?
By Lloyd Berkner and Haddock and Merrill, too.
Yeah, how did these people know what the story was?
Well, I told them what the story was, and I said, do you think I ought to say it? And they
yes.
said, I think you should. They didn't have the intimate knowledge of his work, but I did.
All right.
So I stuck it in the IRE.
Yeah.
The only place it appears is in the IRE. Yes. And it doesn't appear in the address which I gave, which I think is a little bit better to publish.
In conclusion, and you would like to see a joint effort between Bell Laboratories and Jansky and Bailey preparing the chronology.
That's right.
And formalizing
That's right.
All the papers
of them
scientifically and the
That's
profile.
Right.
Of Carl Jansky, and where would this go then?
I think it ought to go to libraries throughout the world as source material. This is where the requests came from. Somebody would be working in this field, and they'd dig around the library to try to find Carl's original work,
yes.
find the original story of his work, the original papers which he wrote. They couldn't find it, so they'd end up writing me. And more recently, I'd want to say, well, I'm sorry, we just don't have it.
Yes.
But,
Would you want to include John Pfeiffer's account as well?
Well, that's a whole book. Yes. I wouldn't say so, because, after all, that is a very fine book for the Cairo in this bureau. It's a book for the...
Did John Pfeiffer actually talk with you at the time?
Oh, many times.
Did he interview you for this book?
Oh, yes, many times. And he also interviewed my sister Helen and other members of the family.
Nice.
Particularly my sister Helen.
Was it William H.C. Higgins?
Nope. Sorry.
You could tell Lance military electronics.
Yeah.
I guess this letter that John Pfeiffer speaks about, where Carl says he wanted to go to University of Iowa, that would be something that Mrs. Jansky would be holding attached to, rather than himself.